Good morning and welcome to hour number two of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. The producers for this program, Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal, and Henry Frain is at the controls. In this part of Focus 580, we'll try to talk a little bit about access to the internet, where the people are best served, where there's still a need to serve people, how it is people get their access to the internet, and the relative roles of perhaps government on the one hand in trying to create that opportunity and private business on the other. And our guest for the program this morning is a scholar who's spent a lot of time studying the issue of communications infrastructure, particularly the areas of wireless and broadband access. His name is Christian Sandvig. He's a professor here at University of Illinois. He's associate professor of communication and a research associate professor at the Coordinated Science Lab of the U of I here in Urbana-Champaign. And he's, as I said, he's particularly interested in communication technology and public policy. And we'll try to tackle some of these issues here. And, of course, questions from people who are listening are welcome as well. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 and toll-free, 800-222-9455. At any point here, questions are certainly welcome. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Well, it's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Just as a general kind of question, and I think that you would have – I hope that you would have an answer to the question is, can you say something about how access to internet access essentially has grown and, you know, the numbers of people who do in fact have access has grown over the last – I don't know what sort of time frame that you might like, 5 years, 10 years, something like that?
Well, I mean, it used to be that we were really concerned about internet access because it seemed that there was a big difference between the people who had it and the people who didn't. Mm-hmm. Sometimes this was called the digital divide. Right. Now we're in a different way of thinking about it, more that we know that there's a big difference between the kind of access that people have. So while there might be a large majority of the population that has some access to the internet, we find that what that means can vary greatly. So, for example, if you're listening to this from a rural area, you might have as your option for internet access maybe only one choice. It could be very expensive. It might be slow. It might be dial-up. If it's not dial-up, it might be something like a satellite link. And a satellite link is a very different kind of internet experience than using the internet from your desktop here at the University of Illinois. Mm-hmm. The current thinking is that there's a big difference between what we say when we mean broadband in different circumstances. So about half of the people in the United States have broadband, but there's a lot of debate over what exactly – how broad does it have to be broadband? How fast does it have to be and what kind of – how expensive and what kinds of things can you do with it and so on.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting. It used to be when we talked about digital divide, that seemed to be – the divide seemed to be between affluent people and low-income people. And while that – I suppose that still exists, there maybe are different kinds of digital divides. One, as you mentioned, has to do with urban-rural. I'm sure that probably urban people, people who live in cities, have many more opportunities to get service either a wire coming into their house or through wireless provided in sort of some number of ways, public institutions and private businesses and so forth.
That's true. Although it's a little bit more varied than you would expect. I haven't been following it in recent years, but just a few years ago, I know in some neighborhoods of Detroit, for example, you can find areas that are extremely urban. So no one would deny that they're urban and there's a very high population density there. But there might be almost no option for high-speed internet access, and that's because of the characteristics of the market. Most people listening, if they have broadband, probably get their broadband from cable television provider or from the phone company. And in some neighborhoods, the cable television provider, even as recently as I said, as a few years ago, haven't been that enthusiastic about providing internet service to some kinds of populations, particularly African-American populations, populations with low incomes, and so on. And they also link it to the other services that they offer in a way that can be tricky. So if you're living in a neighborhood that has few options for broadband, maybe the only option is your cable company, But then the broadband might only be affordable if you subscribe to cable. Most people do subscribe to cable, but if you don't, it might not be a viable option for you. If you look at the pricing from Comcast, it's actually quite expensive to get internet from them if you don't subscribe to cable.
Yeah. You have been involved in something called the RED Project, and that I think is really interesting, and it has been an attempt to, in some, I guess, some representative places, to actually go out and map how much internet is out there so that you could do something. For example, on your website, you can put in your address and get a map and have some idea about how much internet, in a sense, is concentrated. So maybe how many users and what kind of access they have is concentrated where you live. And it can be really dramatic, I'm sure, from one place to the next. What do you think is the usefulness of having that kind of map?
Well, the RED Project, which was really fun to produce, actually, which was produced by our students here at the University of Illinois, the RED Project was a way of thinking about wireless internet specifically. So when I say wireless in this case, I mean the kind of thing that you can go down to Best Buy and purchase. So like an access point, like a Linksys access point. Now, those were designed to help you get internet access in your home to solve some sort of small networking problem you might have. So if you had internet access through your television from your cable company, you might use a Wi-Fi access point so you wouldn't have to run an Ethernet wire up the stairs to your office. And so, but the funny thing about this is that the wireless signals don't care particularly about your property lines or the boundaries of your house. So it's possible to measure how many people are using Wi-Fi just by walking around public places like sidewalks. And I'm sure anyone who has a laptop has noticed. You open a laptop in a public place and you see that there's a lot of different wireless access points there that you can find. So for the research purpose of this, what we were doing is trying to look at the distribution of wireless as a way to think about wireless generally. So it's not that Wi-Fi is itself the most important technology, but that we could think about Wi-Fi as an interesting example of how we might organize wireless access to the internet and media in the future.
Yeah.
So the neat thing about that is with Wi-Fi, it's basically a radio station that you buy at the store. And this isn't the way that we've been taught to think about radio particularly. Normally, we think of radio, we think of there's a dial back when radios had dials, and the dial's a few inches long, and you look at it and you can tell there's not enough room on there for everyone to have their own radio station. But with Wi-Fi, anyone can buy their own radio station. And so the research project was a way to figure out how this might foreshadow newer developments in our management of wireless generally.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting because it seems to me, and you tell me if I'm wrong about this, but it seems to me that when the direction we're going is that access for more and more people, access it does come in some sort of wireless way. Either, as you say, people have set up a little wireless network within their house.
Mm-hmm.
So they're using their computers or their laptops or their iPods or, you know, whatever it is, and they're using it that way. Or that they're going to the library or they're going to the coffee shop or I'm sure around this university there are hotspots everywhere that people are getting their access that way. Now, there still have to be some wires somehow. But is it the case that you think and is it the idea that more and more we're going towards a kind of a wireless world?
Definitely, wireless is becoming a very, very important way to provide internet service, particularly in applications where people are moving around. You gave some, like laptops at the cafe, that sort of thing. Also, the cellular phone networks are really pushing for people to get their wireless via the cell phone network. That doesn't mean that you would necessarily plug a wire into your cell phone. You might just add something to your computer that allowed it to use the cell phone network. Another example of that, I guess, would be the Apple iPhone, which you can make phone calls on. It's a cell phone, but you can also use the internet, and that's a way of using the cell phone network to provide internet service. But it's not that wired networks are going away, but there might be some circumstances, like in downtown areas where people are moving around and in rural areas where wireless might be more economical. So there's definitely some instances where wireless is more and more the future.
Yeah. The other thing is that if we have more and more people doing things wirelessly, does that get to a point where it's conceivably a problem that we have some sort of congestion issues? Again, for example, going back to the RED project, I plugged in my address where I live in Urbana, and it's blood red. I started thinking about it. Well, it's easier to tick off the number of neighbors that I know or I'm pretty sure don't have internet access in their house rather than start to make up a list of all the people who do, because it seems that, as far as I know, almost everybody living within a block of where I live does. And you can, and the map indeed that you see where you do this thing, you go on that website, that reflects that.
Yeah, so I imagine most of those are encrypted.
Yes, and indeed, they are mostly encrypted. That's right.
Yeah, so one of the reasons for the RED project was to try and understand this problem of congestion in wireless, because compared to other services that we use the electromagnetic spectrum for, wireless internet has a really small slice of the spectrum. So it's interesting that you can have a big apartment complex here in the Urbana-Champaign area, and it might have a lot of sort of tech-savvy students living in it. Maybe all of them subscribe to broadband through Comcast or from the phone company, and then they all buy a wireless access point. And in fact, that's not a very efficient use of the amount of spectrum we've allocated for Wi-Fi. In other words, it doesn't actually make that much sense for everyone to have their own Wi-Fi access point, because if everyone starts using it a lot, the performance of the entire apartment building will degrade because everyone's using it. So the RED project was a way that we tried to make measurements about wireless so that we could make some guesses as to when we would encounter these congestion problems.
And when will we encounter those problems? Are we on the way, or are there some places already are experiencing them?
Well, I guess the most broad answer I'd give is that these kinds of problems terrify people like the FCC, because the FCC, their job is to not allow anyone to use the electromagnetic spectrum or wireless without permission in advance. So this Wi-Fi is an example where you get to use a radio station without getting the government's permission first. There's a lot of examples, but they're you could say they're fairly minor. So your baby monitor, your garage door opener, these are radio stations that you don't have to have permission to use from the government in advance. So the FCC, for several years, people have thought, well, if there's some way we can use technology to allow everyone to have their own radio station, then this would turn everything we know about communication in some way on its head, because we used to know that the radio dial has only a few inches and only a few stations can fit. But if there's some way we can manage it more efficiently or use new digital technology, then this might be a new flowering of voices and diverse uses that we otherwise wouldn't see. So the point of the RED project, to get ground this a little bit more in the RED project, was to say, is there some way we can make a prediction about wireless, despite the fact that you, David, didn't have to get permission to go buy your Wi-Fi access point? And we found that actually we can make very good predictions about wireless. So the way to think about the RED project is that it's a little bit like that carnival game, Guess Your Weight. So you walk up to the carnival barker and guess your weight. I'm assuming the game isn't rigged in this example. So you walk up to the carnival barker and guess your weight, and he guesses your weight, but he uses information that you think wouldn't be enough to guess your weight. So that's the same thing we're doing with the RED project. We sent students around to measure Wi-Fi in different neighborhoods in California and Illinois. Then we used information about the demographics of those neighborhoods to predict what kinds of things people would use the spectrum for. So when you type in an address in the RED project, as you did, it's a guess. It may not be right, I have to admit. But it's a guess that says, we think that you'll encounter congestion problems in this spectrum, or we think there'll be about this many people who have wireless access points near you. And again, it's not that wireless access points are that important in the great circle of life, but rather that wireless access points are one way to think about the future of wireless, this idea of not having permission first. So in the past, people worried that they would encounter congestion problems in airport concourses, and they worried that they would encounter them in Manhattan, for example, because these are areas where there's a lot of people, they all have laptops, they're likely all using Wi-Fi at the same time. So one of the things the RED Project found is that there's this incredible local variation. It's not that you can just say, well, if we know that airports are going to be a problem, we'll plan the network differently in airports, but rather that even in otherwise neighborhoods that might look the same, so driving block to block in Chicago or in Los Angeles or here in Champaign-Urbana, there are huge amounts of variation in the wireless that you get. It's not the case that population density, for example, will give you all the information about who's using wireless signals. So the point of this was actually to show that it would be a good idea to allow more people to be able to have their own radio station, because if you can predict in advance how many people will use these systems, then you can try to make some allowance, either a legal allowance or a technological allowance to handle the problem of congestion. Whereas before the RED Project, I think the argument was this is just too risky. If we let everyone have their own radio station, we might be going back to the broadcast wars of the 1920s where no one could be heard because there were no licenses and everyone would just turn on a transmitter and crank up the power.
Hmm. Well, I guess it does make me wonder whether this way that we've been going, and that is that essentially every household, to the extent that they can afford it, has its own access point, and that who knows what the average number of users are. And we certainly know that there is, as you increase the number of users, you may likely to have problems with speed and performance and so forth. But does it really make sense for essentially every house to have its own access point? Or would it make more sense if, as a matter of public infrastructure, we say access to the internet is a public good, so we're going to do something to make sure it's kind of there like power and water is? And that way, everybody doesn't have to have their own router in their house, that it's something that's going to be, in a sense, everywhere, so you can access it no matter where you are in your house, at the coffee shop, or walking down the street.
Absolutely. And collective action is really the way that you would handle some of these problems of congestion, not to allow everyone to have their own access point that degrades service for all potentially. I mean, it depends on what they're doing. So it's not just that more access points. I mean, you can actually have a really large number of access points without seeing a noticeable problem in performance. It just depends a lot on what those people are doing. But our current public policy approach to this has been to do things like arrest people who share Wi-Fi, which is, I think, something that everyone who has a laptop with a Wi-Fi card has probably at one point or another signed on to a wireless network that they weren't exactly sure where it was coming from. Mm-hmm. And so our current approach to this is that it has to be individual, that everyone has to have their own access point. It should be encrypted. Whereas this gets you to really fundamental questions about human behavior very quickly, and about altruism and about sharing. Just a few years ago, there was a lot of excitement about providing the wireless infrastructure that you suggested for everyone, but to do it in some sort of decentralized, non-governmental fashion, just by agreeing that everyone would share their wireless service with everyone else. So there's a number of sharing schemes that popped up that didn't actually take off. But it may be that some more formal action would produce the system that you describe, where wireless would be considered an infrastructure that's a minimum that everyone should have.
Yeah. Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Christian Sandvig. He's Associate Professor of Communication and Research Associate Professor at the Coordinated Science Lab at the U of I here in Urbana-Champaign. He's interested in communication technology and public policy. We've been talking some here about internet access, broadband access in various kinds of ways, and where it is accessible, and maybe something about what are some of the underserved populations and places. Questions are certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. We have a caller over in Belgium, the community, not all that far away. Toll-free line right here. Hello.
Good morning to you all. I have a question, and you have to beg my ignorance here, because I don't know too much about this. I very much enjoyed listening to Mr. Inge on the radio, and his signal only goes so far. And I know that you can get it through Wi-Fi by going to the, you know, internet situation. But I also have heard about this G3, G4, something like that, that's involved with what you just mentioned a few minutes ago about
3G?
Yeah, is that what it is? Three, pardon me. Shows you how much I know, doesn't it? How is that different from Wi-Fi, and how does it work, or can you give me information about that?
Sure. So when we talk about wireless, there's all kinds of things that we could mean. So we absolutely, as you pointed out, could mean the AM radio signal for WILL. And we could also mean, when we say Wi-Fi, we usually mean a consumer device that you are supposed to use to solve small networking problems in your house that has a short range as compared to, say, a radio station, right? So 3G refers to the cell phone networks that I was talking about earlier. They can handle telephone calls, but they can also handle data. So it's possible to subscribe to a data plan from your cell phone provider. And if you have cell phone coverage, you can then use your cell phone to surf the web as well. However, it doesn't have to be limited to your cell phone. So you can get a card to plug into your computer, and some newer computers come with them automatically, where your computer can, I guess you could say, it pretends to be a cell phone, but it only uses the data plan. It doesn't make phone calls necessarily. But so the difference there would be that if you used the cell phone network to get access to the internet, then it would function just like your cell phone. So where you saw bars on your cell phone, that means you would be able to get internet there. There are some big differences in speed depending on where you live. I don't know about Belgium, but I'm betting it doesn't have 3G service.
Well, if we're very close to Danville, so.
I'm betting Danville doesn't have 3G service either. I know Champaign-Urbana doesn't.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, so that means that your service with a data plan on the cell phone would be really quite slow, comparable, although a little better, to a dial-up. Whereas in Chicago, even if you pay the same amount of money, you might have very fast access. Because the companies like all of our local cell phone companies are investing first in the population centers like Chicago. So I guess one benefit for you to get the internet through your cell phone company would be the range. So anywhere you have a cell phone tower, then you would be able to get internet access. However, it might not be that fast.
Now, I might ask another question and just something that I've observed. I have a son that lives in San Francisco, and his girlfriend and him come here regularly to visit us, and she has an iPhone, but yet it seems to work here. So is there more than one aspect that it receives? Because she seems to be able to get G3, if that's what you call it. I don't know. Maybe that's not what it works on.
Yeah, well, the iPhone can act as a Wi-Fi device as well as a cell phone. So if you have Wi-Fi, that's probably what the iPhone is using.
Huh?
Yeah, but the telecom companies don't make a big deal about what I'm telling you because it's terrible PR for them, right? So they don't go out of their way to say, hi, I'm AT&T, and you can get the iPhone and use the internet anywhere, but it will be really slow if you're not in Chicago. So they leave that last part out. Because it's not good marketing for them. So they don't tend to have a lot of information for the consumer about where they have increased the speed on their network. But I could be wrong, but I'm pretty sure that Danville, you're not going to have a really fast network from the cell phone carrier. That's my guess.
If you don't have it in Champaign, I guarantee you we don't have it over here.
But, I mean, it still works. So, I mean, your visitor might just think, oh, it's a little slower than normal, but, you know, the internet is ineffable that way. Sometimes it seems a little slower than normal, and there could be many reasons for it, so you probably wouldn't think anything of it.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks. So again, it's just sort of the appeal of the product and how this moves us forward is that now if you have some kind of wireless device that has Wi-Fi capability and you're within the range of a Wi-Fi network, you can get internet. So you can go down to the Starbucks and you can sit there and you can get your internet. But if you're out in the middle of nowhere, the only way you can get it is if you can indeed, say, use your cell phone, assuming that you're in a place where you can make a call Right. But it's still not – it may not be the level of performance that you'd really like, but at least it is access.
And a lot of the Wi-Fi networks are now encrypted, so you may not be able to use the Wi-Fi network that you find.
Yeah.
That's been the trend.
Well, I tell you what, there's some other questions I want to ask, but let's go. I have somebody here in Terre Haute. We want to talk with them. Let's go there. Line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Could you talk a little bit about the basic differences between how internet access is handled in this country versus European and Asian countries? And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Sure. Yeah. The news of the moment here in the United States is all about President Obama's stimulus plan and all of the investment that's going into the economy. And a bunch of that is directly related to broadband. Particularly, there's money – I think – I don't have these figures memorized, but I think it's about $7.5
billion
for broadband.
Like that, yeah.
Yeah, so but and then some of that is specifically for rural broadband infrastructure here in the United States. So if you think about that number and that kind of investment and you compare it to other countries in Europe or particularly maybe in East Asia, it's really, really low. So it's great that we're putting this money into broadband infrastructure, but other governments have put a lot more money than this. Just to give you a comparison, a nonprofit organization called EduCause made an estimate of how much it would take to invest in broadband in the United States so that we would have what they would consider to be a minimum infrastructure for an industrialized nation. And their estimate was about 14 times higher than what went into the stimulus bill for broadband. So the first difference that really jumps out is the level of investment. Of course, you could also say, wow, the United States is a lot different than these other countries that we're comparing it to. So if you compare the U.S. to a Western European country or to South Korea or to a Scandinavian country, we really have a very different geography. We have all kinds of different features like mountains that are impressively high. We have a very different population distribution. So we have really large rural areas. And that might be why in the U.S. you've seen that we've had some difficulty achieving a bare minimum of access to infrastructure without some sort of elaborate plan. I mean, the thing that comes to mind is the Rural Electrification Administration, which is what we had to do to get electrification in rural areas. So there have been a number of reports that perhaps the caller is alluding to that compare the United States to other countries, particularly European countries. There was a really controversial report from the OECD that said the United States was far behind European countries in broadband. And these numbers are extremely disputed and they're the topic of hot debate. But I think it's really quite straightforward to see that here in the United States, there are many places you can go where you have few options for broadband. They're much slower and more expensive than you would expect in other countries.
Our guest this morning in this part of Focus 580, Christian Sandvig, he is an expert on communications infrastructure, particularly in the area of wireless and broadband access. He's an associate professor of communication and research associate professor in the Coordinated Science Lab here at the U of I. And questions and comments are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Now, I don't want to start a fight here, but apparently someone called in and said that, in fact, there is 3G service available in Champaign.
Oh, that's great. I'm so pleased because when I first went to buy the iPhone, I was disappointed to find out it wasn't available. When I went back, I found that it wasn't available still. So it's great. I know that upgrades to our network have been promised continuously. So it's great. Great to hear.
Okay. One of the things that I read in a paper that you wrote that I thought was really interesting was taking a look at what happened in the early days of telephone service in the United States. And the thing I thought was really interesting, and it sort of goes back to this urban-rural divide, that apparently before 1920, people living in rural areas were actually more likely to have access to a telephone than people in urban areas. And I thought, this is very interesting. Now, after that point, it sort of changed. But apparently the thing was that in the rural areas, there were independents, wildcatters, people who were just going out there and using whatever kind of hardware and technology that was available. They were putting up wires and they were doing what they could to make sure that people could get the service. And I thought that this was really interesting, and I wanted to have you talk a little bit about that. And then, in fact, if there's some sort of lesson to be learned, can you somehow apply that little bit of history now to the question of how it is we get access, internet access, to people who live in rural areas?
Oh, yeah. This is a fascinating topic. The research you mentioned was actually done by a historian and sociologist at Berkeley, Claude Fisher, and he actually did this research where he went to telephone company archives, especially independent telephone company archives, and he found memoranda that the telephone company executives of that period would use, where they would describe their plans for rolling out this high-tech new technology of the day, the telephone. And it's fascinating in part because his argument, which I think he makes very convincingly, is that people often assume that it has to be that rural areas get the new thing slower because there's a higher cost of service. And this is the common wisdom. And you have pictures in your mind of maybe a dusty prairie where people have to stretch miles of copper wire over a row of poles in the middle of nowhere. And it seems, dramatically more expensive. So that's true. But if you think about what the telephone does for people, it's actually a different kind of product in rural areas than it is in urban areas. So if you make a pitch to someone who lives in an apartment building in an urban area in this time and you say, we've got a new technology that will allow you to be connected to your friends more easily, they might say, I'm already really connected to my friends. I live very close to them. Whereas someone in a rural area might see this as much more valuable. And the key point, they might be willing to pay a lot more for it. So Fisher actually unearthed these documents that I think resonate with a lot of people that live in rural areas here in Illinois and are thinking about their internet access, because he found that telephone company executives of the day basically thought that rural people were stupid. They thought that they were stupid hicks who didn't really deserve access to the new technology. So he quotes these memoranda extensively when the executives would say things like, there's no real reason to send the telephone line to these rural areas because these are bumptious customers who would only play banjo to each other anyway. They really, they tend to be troublesome. They complain a lot. They had a lot of negative stereotypes about rural people. Fisher says that one of the reasons you got this pattern of the spread of the telephone is that people who were responsible for spreading the telephone, the telephone company executives, were largely urban people, and they didn't know much about rural areas, and so they rested in the cities because they thought that would be the cheapest way to build a market the most quickly. And then you saw, as David, you mentioned, you saw all of these sort of upstarts, independents, and in some cases illegal operators trying to start service in rural areas because they needed it so badly. So here in Illinois, we have exactly the same sort of dynamic with internet access. I mean, a really good example might be Prairie iNet, I guess, which is an internet service provider that uses wireless technology like Wi-Fi, in part, to provide internet access to small towns. And the nice thing or the interesting thing about their business model is that they only pursue small towns. I haven't checked in on them lately. I don't know the current status of their service, but the last time I looked at it, it was very interesting because their business model took for granted that there would be people in small towns that would be underserved and would want internet service. And so they actually purposefully avoid centers of people, and they only serve small towns in part because for many reasons, but in part because they found that it would be much safer for them to use unlicensed frequencies because there would be fewer transmissions. So they wouldn't want to beam their signals directly through a city that might be congested. Instead, they work around the cities. But there's many other organizations like that. Hmm. That are like the telephone independents in some way.
It still seems that, though, that there's going to be this basic problem, or it seems like there'd be this basic problem that would also have applied to telephone service, and that is if you're going to have to put in some kind of new infrastructure, and your customer base is relatively small, then I would think people will still be asking this question, well, how do we even recoup our costs because the because our potential number of customers is just kind of small. I mean, does that mean that really it's got some government money has to get kicked in? You just have to say something like, you know, the way we did with rural electrification, say, well, you know, this is something that's needed. Private industry won't do it because there's not enough money there. So we're just going to do it.
Yeah. The way that this is done now with the telephone is that everyone who has a landline telephone bill, it might be cloaked under different language, but if you look in that bill, there's usually a line item that says FCC universal access charge. Sometimes it's called federally mandated access charge. It's got a bunch of different names on there. But mainly this is a way to redistribute money from urban users to rural users. This was at least the idea when it was started. And it can be quite a high charge. So the way that this works, the price of telephone service in the U.S. Is typically the same whether you're in a rural area or an urban area. But this charge moves money from the urban to the rural. So Fisher's research might say, you know, you might want to charge more for rural service directly because people would be willing to pay more. But there's definitely some way in which there has to be it's often thought there has to be some sort of incentive structure to be sure that large areas of the country aren't left behind.
Let's talk with caller in Champaign, line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
When I was a student at the U of I not too many years ago, every building on campus was wired for 100 meg, I believe. Is that still the case?
Gosh, I wouldn't know the answer to this question, but it sounds plausible to me.
Okay. Yeah, what I was wanting to know about the technical nuts and bolts of things, basically with the idea that if it were up to me, I would have it as a matter of course and right that every structure in the community and really every dwelling in the country would have very high-speed internet access. And I'm wondering, you know, what's the hardware required? I believe that the wire goes at some point to a fiber optic connection that then goes someplace else and so on and so forth. Do you have any knowledge of that in particular, or is that just outside of your field?
Oh, this is a very common public policy approach. So South Korea, I think, is the law that I'm most familiar with, but they started with new apartment buildings, and they just said that every new apartment building had to be completely wired and had to be able to offer high-speed broadband service. And then this was so successful that I believe that they now passed a law that all old apartment buildings have to have it as well. So in many countries, they have laws that do exactly what the caller is proposing as a way to stimulate investment in communication infrastructure. Otherwise, you get what happens here in our town of Champaign-Urbana, where it might be that there is a fancy high-speed broadband connection available in, say, an apartment house. But this is sometimes billed as a luxury good. Not so much for the students, I think. There, it's more of a necessity. But it can be a way to differentiate a luxury versus an other kind of apartment building.
Well, I'd like to see it as a common right run at the municipal level. You know, the local broadband, one of the local broadband providers, Comcast, is something less than desirable. I find AT&T DSL better, but I'd really have it. If it were up to me, I'd like to see it as a part of the municipal infrastructure that every dwelling, home, so on and so forth has not only water, sewage, light, and broadband internet access, and paid for, say with a city income tax or something like that, and to level the playing field, basically, if nothing else, give every home, no matter how humble, the ability to get out on the World Wide Web and so forth. One can only imagine how that access to information and the possibilities it opened up would increase the common good and common welfare. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you.
I definitely share the caller's frustration about the choices that we have. This is a personal story, but I, at my home in Champaign, wanted to get broadband, and I became really frustrated with the broadband service I was getting. It seemed like a lot of the time it would inexplicably not work, and it would sometimes be slow and sometimes be fast, and And so I went out and I bought something called a load balancing switch. So I bought basically a box that you can plug in a lot of different broadband services to at the same time. And one of the things it will do is it will track how well they perform as compared to each other. I mean, it does other things, but so I then subscribed to every broadband service that I could in town, which I think was three. So I subscribed,
many,
yeah, that many, and then I plugged them all in, and then I carefully tracked them to see which one would be the ideal one that I should really sign up for. And sadly, I didn't find that much difference.
One of the things that I wanted to get back to was the again addressing this digital divide, the one that's more the income question, particularly as it applies to people who live in cities. Mm-hmm. Because as you said, I think we think of urban areas as being a place where there should be no problem having access. And I'm sure that for some people who live in urban areas, they do have no problem. But then there are other places, and it's particularly in disadvantaged communities, when people just don't have the access. Maybe because their cable television is not a possibility, and maybe they don't have phone service, or if it's not very good, you know, whatever. And there have been various places where, reflecting on the kind of viewpoint you and the last caller shared, municipalities have said, well, this is a public good. It's a need. It's something that has to be provided. And that then the idea, I think, is that wireless is the way to go. And they said, well, why don't we just say, we're going to cover either specific places, or we're going to say we're going to cover the whole town in wireless, so that no matter where you are, you have access.
Yeah, and this is, this is most closely associated with what's sometimes called the Philadelphia experiment, mm-hmm. where they attempted to do something just like you propose. So the big revelation for me about income was that it didn't map onto internet use as clearly as I thought, because I thought it would be really obvious and banal to say, well, people without that much money are probably not going to be using the newer communication technologies as much as people with a lot of money. And it didn't seem like a very exciting research question. But in some of our studies of wireless in Wi-Fi in the RED project, one of the things that we did is we sent teams of students to South Central Los Angeles and to a variety of neighborhoods in Chicago, and we measured Wi-Fi. Now, of course, that's not the same as measuring broadband take-up, but usually you would assume that if someone has a Wi-Fi access point, they probably have some broadband connection that they're connected that Wi-Fi access point to. Mm-hmm. But the thing that surprised me is, again, the immense level of variation. And I think this can actually be explained by what we know about people. So, in fact, using a new technology like broadband does have to do with income to a point, but it has to do with a lot of other factors that interact in ways that are really hard to predict. So think about people with a lot of money. I mean, they actually are probably not that interested in Wi-Fi, and particularly because people who have a lot of money tend to be older. If you're talking about a really large amount of money, and age is also a really important way of understanding who's likely to try, say, new communication technologies. Similarly, internet access and broadband access is something of a word of mouth and experience good. So people who use dial-up think, well, I have internet and it works fine for what I want to do, and so why would I need anything else? But then once they try broadband, they see, wow, this is really quite different. I mean, it's called the same word. It's called internet. But using the World Wide Web with dial-up versus broadband is so different that I need to get this new thing. But then so that path depends on them knowing someone that has broadband, or there being a place where there is broadband where they can try it. So the patterns of who will subscribe to the new communication services are actually really hard to predict just using your knowledge of neighborhoods. Like you think, oh, well, you know, West Humboldt Park isn't really that nice a neighborhood, so I guess there won't be any people using broadband there because it looks like a low-income neighborhood. But then it turns out that that's not the case. So this is a little bit of what we tried to explore in the RED project. Definitely what you mentioned, David, about cities and government entities of different jurisdictions stepping in and trying to set a sort of floor for what is the minimum is a way that we often think about infrastructure technology. So you could make a metaphor with roads, another infrastructure. So roads around here, around central Illinois, started off as a private effort. So people made road co-ops. Farmers got together. They built roads if they wanted to have cars. And it was strictly a private operation, and it wasn't necessarily connected together. There weren't things like highway routes. Maps weren't developed for the whole area. But then slowly, as it came to be seen that roads were an essential infrastructure and that it would severely disadvantage some areas if they had none, they became a federal project. And we see this in a lot of infrastructures where early on there's this area of sort of private cooperative action that can be very diverse. You mentioned the telephone wildcats. Mm-hmm. But then later we see something more like AT&T. All those local efforts are aggregated in some way into some sort of giant system. And that could be private or public, but it tends to get a lot more organized and standardized. So it might be that that's where we are for broadband in the United States. And that's indeed, I think, why there's this open proceeding at the FCC right now that is asking the question, how do we develop a national broadband strategy for the United States? And I think that's moving forward right now. I think in a few months we'll hear something more about that.
Okay. One more caller at least in Urbana. Line one. Hello.
Hi there. Mm-hmm. This is Peter Folk. I run an internet service provider here in Champaign, Urbana.
Hi, Peter.
And howdy, Christian. I was sadly the broadband provider that he was referring to when he tried a local provider, and we were very sad to see him go, but we understand why he did it. And I just wanted to speak to some of the issues that he brought up, and especially mention that there is currently in Champaign-Urbana a broadband access committee that is investigating municipal broadband or other models to do ubiquitous to every premise 100 megabits. There are meetings for.
I'm sorry, you're breaking up on us.
Okay. Hopefully I'll try saying it again.
Okay.
There is a broadband access committee with some public meetings. One of those public meetings is on the 9th at the Urbana Free Library. Starts at 10 or 10:30. I don't remember which. It's a public meeting about this topic. And so people who are interested in getting universal broadband access might be well interested in going there. Another thing that was mentioned was whether wireless is a solution for a city like Champaign-Urbana. And in my position as the owner of a wireless internet service provider, I definitely feel that it has a place, but it's not the thing to bring the next generation of connectivity to a dense population like a city. A dense population like a city will need a wireless overlay because there are many devices that are only effective in their mobile form, like phones and laptops and that kind of thing. But it will be a long time before wireless is able to provide the kind of connectivity that a fiber will also provide. So it's sort of like speed versus capacity, or something of that sort, where with a wireless device, you need that mobility for it to provide its key use. Turn that around, though, and look at the areas where a town is developing, and the advantage of wireless is that you can put it in very quickly, and you don't need to plan ahead for when something's going to happen. So if you have both infrastructures in place, then all of a sudden you have a lot more of a flexible system.
Hey, thank you, Peter. You know, your comment about the broadband committee meeting here locally is a good one because I think there's a broader question as to whether this should be a local issue. I get a warm feeling when I think about the citizens banding together and working together on these kinds of problems. There certainly are local problems, but you think about the nation and Champaign-Urbana, I have a really high confidence that some smart grant-getting kind of people are on the lookout for how to get the federal stimulus money to our community. And there's already a lot of people like you in the community who are really tuned into these issues. Then there are other communities that might be in the range of WILL where that might not be the case, where they don't have a really high population of tech-savvy people who are pushing for local organization to produce the next generation of broadband. And so I think we need to have a national conversation as well as to what the minimum standards ought to be for these communities. Unfortunately, a lot of our efforts so far, like the stimulus package and the use of TOP grants or block grants, really assume that some communities are the communities we need to help are the ones that can organize to seek this funding. And there may be actually many communities that don't have the expertise to produce this kind of application to a block grant or a TOP grant program.
So I definitely think that that's been the focus of the stimulus funding. And I personally do not feel that the stimulus funding is anywhere near sufficient for what we need to be doing in even in this area where we're already relatively well connected. But my reading of the stimulus bill is that really it's setting up a bunch of little test beds around the nation. And over the next couple years, the NTIA is supposed to be investigating those test beds and coming up with a national broadband policy or strategy.
Definitely, yeah. I think Obama said that this was not going to solve the problem. It was just the beginning.
My apologies here for jumping in. I'm going to have to do that because we're here at the end of the time. We're going to have to leave it at that, but with the promise that we'll see if we can continue to follow these issues. Maybe we'll talk about this again. I want to thank the caller and also thank our guest, Christian Sandvig. He's an associate professor of communication and research associate professor at the Coordinated Science Lab at the University of Illinois. He's interested in communication technology and public policy.